Jesus as the Master Teacher. Commentary for the October 31st, 2020 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. Matthew 5, verses 1 and 2. The Bible tells us that in the beginning God walked with mankind in the Garden of Eden. What an experience that must have been. But how can God, who is ineffable, eternal, immortal, and omniscient, find value in that? It would be as though I found it important to walk side by side with an ant discussing how its day went. Why would God lower himself to do such a thing? Perhaps because of love. Have you ever created something challenging so that you were especially proud of it? Things like that have a way of finding a special place in our hearts. When something happens to harm or destroy that special creation, we can become heartsick at the loss. I can almost hear the tears in God's voice when he came for his usual walk with his special creation, Adam and Eve, and found they were hiding from him. He knew that they had been damaged, their innocence lost. Carefully, he explained to them the changes that would now come about. That which had been easier in their innocence would become harder, tainted by selfishness and struggle. Some might wonder how God, who spans eternity, was able to walk so intimately with mankind back then. The Bible gives us clues in the epistles of the New Testament and in the words of Jesus in the Gospels. We are told that Jesus was the active agent of creation, bringing the world into existence, including mankind, who was intended to rule over the world. Jesus identified himself as God by referring to himself as the I Am, just as God said when he spoke from the burning bush to Moses, and the Jews understood that reference and considered it blasphemy. The Hebrew letters of the Old Testament that refer to God's name are a form of the verb to be. In other words, God is considered the source of all being, all existence. Saying that he is the I Am is to say that he wants to connect with us on that level. Our life derives from him, and the natural response would be for us to turn toward that light of life as naturally as a sunflower follows the sun. Something within us seeks that connection, but shame and guilt causes us to turn away from the light. Like Adam and Eve, we try to hide in the darkness of the bushes and trees when we fear God is near. But he reassures us that we should not let that stand in our way. 2,000 years ago, he did not come to judge us. He came to restore what was lost and repair what was broken. The prophet Isaiah tells us that those who respond to his call will be known as repairers of the breach that was made so long ago in Eden. What a privilege it must have been for the disciples to be able to walk and talk with someone who had walked and talked with mankind in the beginning. But they did not understand the opportunity. Instead of plumbing the depths of creation and the intent and meaning behind their own existence, they tended to think only about seeing Jesus as a means to power over their enemies and as an avenue to freedom from want and disease. But in all fairness, most were simple fishermen and villagers, not used to grappling with issues much deeper than whether or not there will be enough fish to feed their family, with some left over to sell in the market. They saw money as an avenue to self-sufficiency, which may have been why Jesus taught so many lessons about it. Lessons that they remembered and recorded in the Gospels. John referred to himself as a disciple Jesus loved. A bit of self-promotion that seems to fit with his propensity to argue about who should be the closest to Jesus. Jesus had tremendous patience for all of his disciples. He was able to teach them without being condescending, even though it would have been a natural response. For instance, how meaningless it must have seemed to him for the disciples to argue about who gets to sit next to God, who is omnipresent. That reality means that everyone who chooses to sit next to God can, because they are already next to his presence. But while Jesus made some inroads teaching them about the divine character and the love it contained, he found that the disciples struggled with understanding his nature. But they were not alone. Theologians have struggled to define the indefinable nature of God for thousands of years. The First Council of Nicaea in 325 AD argued the point vociferously as to whether the Son of God was the same substance as God the Father or only similar. Homoousios versus homoiousios. Such theological hair splitting has defined the Christian church even to the present day. But such arguments are most often done by apologists and are based on two assumptions, both false. The first assumption is that it is possible to have a perfect understanding of God's nature. This ignores the limitations of our own nature. For instance, we cannot draw a picture of infinity. The best we can do is to symbolize it with a figure eight lying on its side. But God is infinite by definition, and therefore equally impossible to draw. Perhaps this is why the Ten Commandments precluded attempting to make such images. Any attempt would have to be a lie, in the same way that a sleeping figure eight cannot be infinity in any real sense. For the same reason, the Bible is able to depict the character of God as love, a concept we can grasp even though we have difficulty realizing it in our lives. But its attempts to define God's nature are only literary placeholders for reality. We can say God is omnipresent, but like the disciples, we struggle with that idea. For instance, we think we must be somewhere special to be close to God, but that is a denial of his omnipresence. God is no more present in a special building than he is in our backyard. To think he is represents the primitive religious thinking of those ancient worshipers who thought God was residing in their valley or on their hilltop, and that moving to a different location meant learning how to worship a different God of that place according to the local rituals. When we begin to understand what Jesus tried to reveal about the nature of God, much of the religious structure we have built over many centuries becomes superfluous to worship in God's presence. It also makes denominationalism ridiculous. It is the starkest irony to teach others that Jesus died upon the cross for the sins of all mankind, but to insist that our denomination is the one he died the most for, guaranteeing a special status for those who are wise enough to recognize our specialness. Our tendency to believe that we know God so much more perfectly than anyone else, and then condemning others for not recognizing it, is tantamount to blasphemy. This is what wrung from the lips of Jesus, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." The second unwarranted assumption that gives rise to apologetic denominationalism is that God needs us to defend him. God the omnipotent becomes God the impotent without our arriving to save the day. But the truth is that we cannot even save ourselves, let alone be defense attorneys for God. And why would we even feel we need to be? God was exonerated before the entire universe on a cross, on Golgotha. What more can be added to that? But we continue to try to defend God, just as we continue to try to add our own works to the formula for salvation. Whatever we do to make ourselves appear righteous is only filthy rags. But instead of repenting in sackcloth and ashes for our presumption, we boldly step forth and proclaim that we are the uniquely authorized mouthpieces for God, and that salvation depends on membership in our denomination. If the new convert finds Jesus somewhere along the way, so much the better. But the sure test of that discovery is too often determined by the rules the denomination has voted upon, with little consideration for the fruit upon the tree. Strangely, the servant leadership model that Jesus showed is rarely to be found in those rules. We have all heard of the fruit inspectors who judge the genuine experience of others by their fruits. But what standard do they use? Do they use the fruits of the Spirit as Paul outlined them? Love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control? Or are they determined to be based on peculiarities of worship formats, diet, or veneration of other human beings? Does God's nature find expression in our lives? Or do we practice religion despite that? Perhaps instead of trying to defend our picture of God, we should consider simply surrendering to Him and relieving ourselves of the burden of being God's public defender. He can supply a better defense than that should He need to. He assures us, "If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all that is in it." Thank you for listening to this commentary. You can find the footnotes that give the scripture references for the ideas referred to in this commentary at our website at Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. May God bless you and your family.